the PG&E Diablo Canyon Power Plant presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The board directed us to come back to you with a summary of what the technical working group has come up with in terms of mitigation options regarding the Pacific Gas and Electric Company Diablo Canyon Power Plant cooling water issues. The way that we have this set up today is that our staff presentation is going to be a co-presentation from Michael Thomas and from Dr. Pete Raimondi. And we anticipate that that will take under 25 minutes. And Pacific Gas and Electric Company has requested a like amount of time, which the chair has granted. And then after that, after board questions, we'll go to public testimony. So Michael Thomas.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Roger. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, in July of 2003, the board held a hearing on the Diablo Canyon Power Plant MPDS permit, and attached to that permit was a settlement agreement. The board heard all the testimony with respect to all of the issues associated with that permit and deferred a decision on the permit and directed staff to come up with more information on mitigation options for specifically for entrainment. So staff reconvened the technical work group and the independent scientists, and we directed the independent scientists to investigate additional mitigation options and specifically marine reserves, because during the July 2003 hearing, a discussion on marine reserves led to the board directing us to investigate that option further. So we came back to the board in May of 2004 and gave the board an update on mitigation options and including marine reserves. The board then directed us to get more information on artificial reefs. So the presentation today is going to be on the mitigation options, the information that we have today, and much of that will be updating the board on what we've learned about artificial reefs. And to do that, Dr. Raimondi from UC Santa Cruz is here. Dr. Raimondi is one of the board's independent scientists. We also have Dr. Foster from Moss Landing Marine Labs is here today, and Dr. Kaye with Moss Landing Marine Labs. So if you have questions about the biology associated with anything you hear today or the power plant impacts, we'll be able to answer those for you. With that, I'll hand it over to Dr. Raimondi.
As Michael said, the two things that we were directed by the board to address in this next informational meeting were marine reserves and artificial reefs. And artificial reefs we came to somewhat reluctantly because we hadn't considered it before. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go over both of these approaches as two of the possible mitigation options that might be used for Diablo Canyon. The first thing I want to do is I just want to briefly review the estimation of larval loss resulting from entrainment, because that's the basis of both of these recommendations. And there's been substantial changes since the last meeting that reflect a recalibration of the analysis, the empirical transport model analysis that was done by Tenera and PG&E, and that we both groups, buy into. So there has been a recalibration of the analysis. It has very little impact in the subsequent analysis that I've done and with the technical working group, but there are numbers that would be different than would be in the original 316B, and they were provided by Tenera in, when was that, John? About June, February?
Yeah.
About February of this year, and so they reflect somewhat new information. These are the new estimates that we've included in our most recent submission of the technical working group with respect to mitigation options. So these are correct as of June 30th, 2005. And the main point that I want to bring from this is summarized in the next slide, and that is that the best estimate of larval loss resulting from entrainment at Diablo Canyon is about 10.75% of larvae associated with rocky reef organisms, fish primarily, over a 74-kilometer stretch of coast. What that means is that The best approximation of larval loss is that about 11% of the larvae have been lost from what we consider to be the source water body. That is the area where larvae are at risk to loss. And that's over about a 74-kilometer stretch of the coastline. And that's the basis of the artificial reef calculations. And so understanding this is a key component of the whole calculation that's going to follow. The major limitation of the entrainment, and I say major limitation not in the sense that this is a criticism of the 316B study. I've said it before, and PG&E has noted this, and I'll say it again, that the 316B study that was done at Diablo Canyon is, in my opinion, and still is, the best entrainment study that's ever been done in the state of California. It may be the best entrainment study that's been done in the United States. I'm just not as familiar with cases outside of this. And so I'm very comfortable with the approach that was taken and the results that have been presented and the work that was done by Tenera. The major limitation of this approach, and this is true of all entrainment approaches, not just this one, is that only direct effects on a subset of taxa could be evaluated. So we couldn't evaluate indirect effects. There were no higher order effects evaluated, like effects on ecosystem function. And I bring this up because these are always criticisms of any entrainment study that you haven't looked at indirect effects or higher order effects. That's just the nature of the beast. It's hard enough to do it on a target set of organisms without going to indirect effects or higher order effects. So this is a pyramid that we've oftentimes used, and it scales down. There's a lot of things that are entrained. There's fewer of those that are larval organisms, which are the subject of the entrainment study. Fewer of those are sampled, and fewer of those are targeted for analysis. That doesn't compromise the study. It's just a recognition that there's a difference from what is entrained and what we are actually able to study, or what PG&E and Tenera was actually able to evaluate. Ecosystem effects, which are things above this level, all the things that use planktonic organisms, were completely unstudied. And that, again, is just the nature of these sorts of examinations, and is not a fundamental criticism of the approach. Entrainment at Diablo Canyon. Now, what you directed us to do was to look at ecological mitigation options, three that were, and what we want to do with this is to provide options that will compensate, at least in part, for entrainment effects. This is very difficult to do in open coast systems, and that's why we've got a very small set of alternatives. And to provide alternatives, engineering options, for example, dry cooling. I want to make a point right here. The technical working group, the independent scientists, have no recommendation about any of these things. We're presenting scientific options, and we're not here to make policy recommendations about which one is preferable. And we're just going to use this as an opportunity to come up with what our approximation is as to what is more likely or less likely to compensate for mitigation or for entrainment. The ecological mitigation options that we've considered are these three, primarily conservation easement, which we've gone over repeatedly, and is much more appropriate for the thermal effects. The marine reserves, which I'll talk about in a second, and artificial reef, and again, this is mainly for entrainment effects. So these two I'm going to concentrate on today, marine reserves and artificial reefs. First, marine reserves. These are the potential roles for marine reserves, and there's a lot more information in the summary or in the white paper that has been provided to everyone, Michael? That's been provided to everyone. So I'm just going to briefly go over these. Marine reserves serve as population buffers, in theory, replenishment areas, and can serve for conservation. They can increase the sustainability of populations. They can protect open spawning sources for certain species. They can increase reproductive capacity. They have led to greater recruitment success, particularly of sessile things like abalone. They can protect habitat, they can reduce bycatch, and they can assure functional ecosystems. And one of the things that I want to do is I'm just going to give you some of these things that have actually been shown in the literature, because many of these things have been proposed, and fewer of them have been shown in the literature to be true. So a few of these, population, reduced size because of catch primarily, reduces fecundity of age and age, and reduces larval production and recruitment. This particular point is the fundamental point behind compensation that might be provided by marine reserves. Remember, what was lost were larvae. And for marine reserves to compensate, at least in part for larval production or larval numbers, they have to be shown to produce more larvae than would a comparably sized fished area, as an example. So the data that support this, and all these points here have a strong set of data to support this, are really presented here, and this is just a subset of the data. These are from some local species. And what all we're showing here, and this has been shown by National Marine Fisheries Service, is that you get a scaling of fecundity. This is number of eggs on the y-axis versus the size of the fish on the x-axis. So for, as an example, for the yellowtail rockfish, when the fish essentially doubles in size, you get a sevenfold increase in egg production or larval production. The same thing would be true. This is actually larval production because they're rockfish. The same thing is true for vermilion rockfish. You get an 11-fold increase for about a doubling of size, actually less than a doubling of size. So the idea behind marine reserves, and I have to say that this is sort of the fundamental basis of the use of marine reserves as a compensatory mechanism for entrainment, is that you're going to produce bigger fish, and bigger fish are going to produce proportionally or disproportionately more larvae. That's the fundamental basis of marine reserves, if you're going to consider it as compensatory for entrainment. Okay, here are some other things that have been shown. Small populations are less buffered. There's this thing that's called an Allee effect, which is true in many species, which says when populations get very low, you have very slow recovery of fish or other things. This has been shown repeatedly, and the primary examples of this are cod and abalone. Genetic consequences of reducing average size and age of fish, genetic diversity, and so on. These are all, I'm putting these on here so that if you have concerns about whether there's scientific evidence for the benefits of marine reserves, you can go to the literature and take a look at this. But I'm not going to go over in detail. That's not the point of this. Again, so here are the potential roles for marine reserves, and I've talked about all these. But the other major role for marine reserves is this, and that is you've got conservation of habitat. So you can protect habitat into the future for conservation reasons, and that is equivalent to wilderness areas on land, setting aside so there can be no take. And this is not a direct compensatory mitigation. This is something that is apart from that, that is a benefit to the marine resources, and that doesn't have as clean a nexus to the losses caused by entrainment. And that's why when we presented this information earlier, you directed us to go back and take a look again at artificial reefs, because it was clear that there was the potential for artificial reefs to provide a much closer nexus to the losses at Diablo Canyon, which were primarily to larval organisms. And that's what we did, and that's what I'm going to present now. Well, actually, after these attributes of marine reserves with respect to entrainment effects. The first is density might be greater in reserve than non-reserve areas. That's been shown. Individual size may be greater in reserve than non-reserve areas. Fecundity scales non-linearly with fish size, and production of larvae per unit area is greater in reserve than non-reserve areas because of 1, 2, and 3. Hence, marine reserves may compensate for entrainment impacts through increased production of larvae. The shortcomings of marine reserves with respect to entrainment effects are the following. Only harvested species are likely to show increased density in reserves than non-reserve areas. Individual size may be greater only for harvested species in reserve versus non-reserve areas. Production of larvae, which is the key currency here, per unit area, is likely to be greater in reserve than non-reserve areas, again, only for harvested species. Most entrained species at Diablo Canyon are not harvested. There is uncertainty as to whether funding for the settlement from Diablo Canyon would directly contribute to the establishment of marine reserves, for example, the monitoring and enforcement as required under the Marine Life Protection Act. Hence, marine reserves may only partially, and I say partially in the sense of direct, compensate for entrainment impacts through the increased production of larvae. There's a few other issues that are associated with the establishment of marine reserves as mitigation. One is, how big should they be? And if you direct us to it, we can figure that out. We haven't done it this far because it takes some study to do this, and we weren't directed at this. But we can figure it out, and we've figured out the mathematics to do it. Second, and I've listed it down here just so that you know what the approach would be. Second, should they be assessed for performance? What happens if they don't produce the amount of larvae that we expect them to produce? Would there be remediation? Would they scale up? There's these questions that are more policy than anything else that would have to be addressed. Who should pay for enforcement? If they're set up, who should pay for enforcement? Should that be cost borne by mitigation, or should that be fish and game, or should it be the state, or should it be a separate tax? What should it be? And again, what if larval production is lower than expected? Does the whole thing get reopened? So based upon these concerns, you addressed us to look at artificial reefs, and that's what we've done. And we've gone through a process that included the technical working group, which included outside scientists, the independent scientists that Michael's alluded to, Tenera also. That's not to say that everyone bought into this, but there was consultation with all these people throughout. And PG&E has their own response to this that they're going to be presenting right after this. So, to reiterate, the best estimate of larval loss resulting from entrainment is that 10.76% of larvae associated with rocky reef organisms were lost over a 74-kilometer stretch of coast that's about 3 kilometers wide. That's the domain of the source water body. There are two, after consultation and examination of the data, there are two possible source water body extents, number one and number two. Number one, and these are both about 74 kilometers long, number one is roughly centered on Diablo Canyon, the entrainment or the intake there, and so it extends north and south. Number two is a linear source water body, again, biased to the north, which means that our expectation is that most of the larvae probably came from the north to the south before they were captured in the intake. There are sort of these two possible approximations of where the source water body is likely to be on average. And they have different impacts on the estimate of the size of the artificial reef, and that's why I'm presenting them here. Here's the logic of the reef calculations. It's fairly straightforward. Most of the species that are entrained, at least that we've examined, are rocky reef taxa. If an artificial reef was constructed that provided an area equal to 10.76% of the rocky reef in that 74-kilometer source water body, then it's possible that most of the entrainment impacts would be compensated for under the provision that the artificial reef performed as well as the natural reefs in the area. Even if the reef was not built, the estimate of the cost for such a reef provides a robust estimate of the value of the biological resources lost to entrainment, in our opinion. This is not an economic statement. This is just a statement saying if we know how much it costs to provide the habitat that would replace those resources, that's an estimate of the value of those resources.
Do you know what that estimate is?
I'm coming to it. Yep. Yeah. All right. So how much rocky reef is there in the 74-kilometer area? Because that's the first question. That's why we need the source water body. That's why we need to know where that source water body is, so we can then approximate how much rocky reef is in that area. No one really knows. That's just a simple truth. So we must make an estimate. We're going to use kelp maps as the first approximation because, fortunately, Fish and Game has done a wonderful job over the last 15 years of mapping kelp up and down the state of California. And in this part of the world, kelp only grows on rock. And so it pretty much grows on rock if there's rock available. So this is a pretty good first approximation of where rock is up to a certain depth zone, because kelp doesn't grow below a certain depth zone. So then we have to apply a multiplier to account for non-kelp rocky areas. Okay, here's Fish and Game map of the area around, this is the Avila Point Bouchon area, to determine the area of kelp. And what we used was a 1989 to 2002 composite map. This is in the GIS system. What this shows is any place the kelp has grown over the samples that have been taken between 1989 and 2002. So this is an incredibly valuable resource for all sorts of reasons, and we used it in this case here. There's these same sort of maps for the whole state of California. And so you can see those areas that are hatched in brown are areas where kelp has grown during that period of time.
Can
you
give
them that new scale? Sure. Just to indicate where we're talking about, this is the Avila to Point Bouchon area, and that whole area there is about 10 miles long. And so what we're talking about is is the extent of kelp offshore and alongshore. And the way that the GIS system works is that it actually calculates the area of kelp that occurred during that period of time. And so we know that rock occurred in those areas, that rock occurs in those areas at a minimum. There's probably other rock too, and that's why we have to apply a multiplier to it. The same thing is true. This is just, I blew that up so you can see the kelp, but the same thing is true if we look along this entire stretch of the coastline from up near Piedras Blancas down to Point Conception here. And these are the aerial extents of the source water body. This is one version of it. This is the other version of it. And so it was not a very difficult thing to figure out how much kelp area were in these two areas, this one and this one. This is just a matter of integrating in the GIS system over those areas. And so that we can come up with the estimate of hard rock that has kelp on it. And again, then we have to use a multiplier. So here are the two lines, line one and line two. This is line one. This is the balanced one. This is the one that's biased to the north. Line 1 and line 2, the kelp area in hectares is about, and that's about 2.4 acres, is 792 hectares, or about 1,900 hectares. That's the truth. So that's what was there during 1989 to 19, to 2002. If you say that's all the rock that there is, and using the piece of M estimate that we've come up with, 10.76, then the artificial reef that would be required to compensate using line 1 would be about 85 hectares, and using line 2 would be about 200 hectares. So our first estimate is that the artificial reef would have to be somewhere around 85 to 206 hectares. Now, what if we're wrong and there's actually a whole bunch more hard rock out there that would contribute to the fish stocks or the fish larval stocks out there? What would we want to, you know, what would we want to propose with respect to an artificial reef? We looked at where we had side scan sonar, which isn't a whole bunch of places, but where there is side scan sonar that extends from the shoreline out to 3 kilometers to find out what would be a reasonable estimate of rock that would not have kelp on it. And this is work that's been done up at Cal State Monterey by Rick Kvitek. And there are areas, none local, but there are areas up and down the coast. And based upon those data, and our also where we've done surveys for fish populations, we came up with an upper end in terms of a multiplier of 2. So what we think, though we have not ground truth that here, and I want to be absolutely clear that this multiplier that I'm proposing here has not been ground truth in this particular area, is that the likely upper limit for the multiplier, meaning the what you would multiply the rock by, is 2. So that would mean that if you wanted to know, you know, the upper limit of the rock that would be needed, or the artificial reef, it would scale between 170 and 412 kilometers. So the range then is of new reef that would be needed is somewhere between 85 and 400 hectares, okay? Accounting for a level of uncertainty, with the caveat that this multiplier is probably the most controversial part of this, because we don't have, and no one has, data for this particular area with respect to the amount of rocky reef that does not have kelp on it in this area. All right, now what about the quality? I said earlier this only works if the artificial reef works well. Now, the only real example of a fully blown or a large artificial reef that's ever been proposed or constructed in California is SCAR, San Clemente Artificial Reef, where there are currently 56 modules that were used in an experiment to figure out how to build out the SONG, San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station, artificial reef, which will be 150 acres. So it'll be 150 acres, about 60 hectares. And based upon that experiment has just ended this summer, and it's been running for 5 years. And based upon that experiment, artificial reefs, at least down in that area, performed at least as well as did natural reefs with respect to fish production, and presumably then also with respect to larval production. So they did really well with respect to fish and in macroinvertebrates, which are the two primary things that were in train. And there's a lot more detail, if you want it, about the San Clemente artificial reefs. Now, here are the cost. The cost is based upon SCAR, which is San Clemente artificial reef, where the rock placement and purchase costs $125,000 per, this is per hectare, actually. And so if you scale it up, then the cost associated with these artificial reefs would scale between about $10 and $50 million. 10 for 85 hectares, 50 for 412 hectares, based upon the cost associated with the construction of the reefs at San Clemente Artificial Reef, which are the best costs we have. Now, I've talked to Connolly Pacific. We've talked to Connolly Pacific, which is the contractor for those artificial reefs, to see whether we could get a better estimate for this area up here, and they suggested that we could, but we would need to know something about the size, configuration, location before we could come up with more precise cost estimates, and that's something we'd have to talk about if this is a direction that the board directed, and we could come up with much more precise. This does not, as PG&E correctly points out, this does not include any costs associated with permitting, with monitoring for compliance, or for any other thing that was done in anticipation or after the construction of the reef. This is the simple construction cost estimate.
Compliance with what?
Well, as an example, if the board directed that there be a certain level of larval production that was put out as a basis underlying this reef. Let's say that we said artificial reef, 85 hectares. We put out the artificial reef, 85 hectares. The underlying assumption that it's going to provide a certain number of larvae, because that would be compensatory. And if the board directed that that has to meet that level of production, then there'd have to be some sort of compliance monitoring to figure out whether it actually met that compliance. And that's exactly what is being done at San Onofre, is that there is compliance monitoring for the production of fish and other things And so it all depends upon whether the board directs there to be compliance or not, and remediation if there's noncompliance. So those are all policy decisions. All right. Some additional remarks. The artificial reef proposed is based upon the idea that it would not be a marine protected area. This is, and if the artificial reef were designed as a no-take marine reserve, the projected size and the cost of the reef would decrease. So if this is based upon the idea that it is not a marine reserve, this particular version. The most problematic parameter used to calculate reef size is the multiplier used to estimate the amount of rocky reef that is not associated with kelp that produces significant numbers of larvae of the species that are entrained. It's likely we could come up with a more precise estimate than 2, but we think that the upper value is not greater than 2. The cost projected for the reef does not include any costs associated with monitoring for performance. Artificial reefs cannot be located in all sandy locations. And as a sort of caveat also, our proposed location, just in general, would not be in the immediate vicinity of Diablo Canyon. There's plenty of rock there. You don't need any more rock in that area there. It would be somewhere in Estero Bay or south of Avila. It would be somewhere in a long stretch of sandy bottom habitat where there is no current rocky reef, and where the construction of an artificial reef might actually add to the production of fish and larvae, because it would cause there to be an artificial reef in a place where there current hard rock in a place where there currently is any hard rock.
Have you taken into consideration the loss of the native pre-artificial habitat biota?
Not directly, but we have estimates of what would be lost in a sandy bottom habitat, and it's not insignificant. You know, there's going to be flatfish that would be lost, there's going to be some invertebrates, but compared to the biomass that's associated with the artificial reef, it's essentially insignificant on a per acre area. Now, having said that, and this has been pointed out, we've given essentially the same talk to the marine interest group down in Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo, and having said that, San Luis Obispo County is blessed with a lot of hard rock. And so it's not as though, like down south near San Onofre, there's, you know, a large gaps where there is no hard rock, and hard rock down there is really a commodity. Up here, the estimate is that about along the shoreline, that about 60% of the near shore area is hard rock. And so it's not like down there where it's about 15% is hard rock. So there's quite a bit of hard rock here. So you would be adding hard rock using an artificial reef to an already hard rock replete area here. That's not to say it wouldn't produce. It would produce. It's just that this is not a commodity here. And so if anything, near shore sand is more of a commodity in terms of habitat, not biomass, than is rock. They cannot be located in all sandy locations. The work done in preparation for the scar reef could be used to help locate suitable sites. And in particular, the sand lens has to be fairly thin, because otherwise the artificial reef goes and it sinks. And so you have to put it in a location where there is bedrock or emergent rock that's not too far below the sandy bottom, or else you might lose the artificial reefs through subsidence. We have lost none of the artificial reefs down south through subsidence, and that's because we paid a lot of attention to where to put these things. Conclusions, 2 more slides. An artificial reef of sufficient size and appropriate design and placement could, in our opinion, compensate for the majority of impacts associated with entrainment at Diablo Canyon. Based upon empirical transport modeling and estimates of rocky reef habitat in the source water body, the estimated range of size is sufficient to compensate for entrainment losses is between about 85 and 412 hectares. The estimated cost for the construction of these range and reef sizes ranges from $10.6 to $51 million. The cost associated with the construction of the artificial reef is an estimate of the value of the lost resources. There are many other ways to calculate these estimates of the value of the lost resources. This is one of them, in my opinion. The reef, if of sufficient size and of proper design, has the potential to compensate for almost all the entrainment impacts, because the artificial reef is, in essence, replacing a natural reef of similar size from which nearly all resources save the substrate have been lost. And so it's a really direct way, and probably the only direct way, to compensate for the losses. So our general assessment with respect to marine reserves and artificial reefs is mitigation options. The most direct ecological compensation for entrainment would be provided by the construction of an appropriately sized artificial reef. A robust estimate of value of the resources lost to entrainment is provided by cost estimates for the construction of an appropriately sized artificial reef. Finally, the establishment of appropriately sized, appropriately designed, appropriately enforced, and also appropriately monitored marine reserves for conservation. And I use the word very explicitly here, conservation, this is not for fisheries management, is likely to provide greater and longer-term value to the marine environment, but indirect, than the construction of an artificial reef in the Diablo-Estero Bay region. And that's the end of this presentation. And I don't know, do we take questions now, or does PG&E go?
No, we can have more questions now if we want. Mr. Hayashi?
So this, the way I look at this thing, this could be a build it and they will come.
It's not just, it could be, it will be.
It will be?
It will be.
All right.
There's no question about that. Every artificial reef that's ever been built in California that has been done properly, meaning not in too shallow water, has at least been really beneficial for fish. Now, there are some ones down in Southern California that have not been normal. They haven't provided habitat, as an example, for kelp. But when you look at the fish production, the macroinvertebrate production, it's through the roof.
So if you go the other way around and you put on as a no-take area, how much would be the conversion?
I can give you my guess, but I could give you a much more precise estimate if we worked on it a little bit.
Well, just a guess.
I would say that it would probably be about 80% of the current estimates. So it wouldn't, it'd go down by maybe 20%. That'd be my guess.
Okay.
Is that from a no-take to a take zone?
That would be from, this is a take. The artificial reef has presented 85 to 400 is a take. And that's because we are basing it upon the current conditions there, which are take. And if you turned it into a no-take, or one of the things that people have suggested to us is, because of the MLPA processes, split it and make half of it no-take and half of it take, and then you have a perfect way to examine the benefits of marine reserves, because it'd be the same reef, but one half take and one half no-take. And so the idea that we're showing here is based upon a complete take area.
Then the artificial reefs, in my understanding on your presentation, would be all hard rock?
They'd be a mixture of hard rock and soft rock. The best estimate of the amount of hard rock, let's say that we're looking at an area the size of this room, right? And we say this is a rocky reef habitat, and it is. And if you looked at the kelp photos, it would show kelp over the canopy for the whole thing. But when you go on the ground and you measure the amount of hard rock that's actually there, it's somewhere around 40%, 40 to 50%. So it's rock and intermittent sand over the whole scale of reef. And so that's what we put down, 40 to 50%.
Are there other manufactured artificial reefs?
You mean, are there other artificial reefs?
Yes, other than hard rock.
There's concrete. We did, though, down in San Onofre, we put in one. This is Song's mitigation, that where half the modules were concrete and half the recycled concrete, and half the modules were quarry rock, and they performed essentially the same. We did this because at the time that the reefs were proposed, there was tons of recycled concrete around because it was remnant from the earthquake. It's since been all bought up and it's been shipped to China. And so right now, concrete is much more expensive than quarry rock. Yes.
So if I could just summarize, then your group's recommendation is for marine reserves?
Our group's recommendation is for neither one of these things. Our group proposes that if direct compensation, using a mitigation option, not an engineering solution, but using a mitigation option of the two that we've explored, that if direct compensation is the policy that the board wants to pursue, artificial reefs are the way to go. If benefit to the marine environment is the route that the board wants to go, marine reserves are the way to go. And that, to us, seems a policy decision. So we can provide you with our, if you say we want to have a direct nexus, and we want to use an ecological mitigation, it's reefs. If you want to say we want to use ecological mitigation and we want to provide the best benefit to the marine environment over the longest period of time, we would say marine reserves.
Well, why not an artificial reef in a perpetual no-take zone? Why wouldn't that be better than
scale.
the marine reserve?
As Michael says, we haven't scaled the marine reserve yet, but my guess is that the size of the marine reserve that we would advocate as in part compensation for entrainment would be much larger than 400 hectares.
Because a marine reserve is essentially habitat that currently exists.
That's protected. You know, from any current or future take.
It is not yet protected.
It's not yet protected.
It would be protected.
It would be. That's right.
But we're not creating new habitat.
We are not. No. And that's why we want to be very careful about saying that in terms of compensation, marine reserves are going to be difficult to justify because, as we said earlier, only certain species are likely to crank up their larval production. Larval production is really the basis of the entrainment impact. A whole bunch of species that are, you know, non-harvested species, sculpins and gobies and, you know, a whole bunch of other types of species, are their numbers are likely not to change at all in terms of larval production in a marine reserve. They may, in fact, even go down because if you get big foraging fish, they may eat some of these little things. And so with respect to direct compensation, we cannot argue for marine reserves. For indirect benefit to the marine reserve, to the marine system, then we think that marine reserves have a lot to offer. And as Michael pointed out, it's mainly because of scale, the size that you set aside.
Because of size.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The amount of habitat that we're talking about with the two options.
But is there sufficient... I mean, you said there's a lot of rocky habitat in that region.
Oh, tons.
Yeah, tons. But what order of magnitude then are we talking about? Is it? I mean,
well,
your estimate, and you haven't looked at it yet. Is
I
it
haven't
two,
looked at it, and I don't even
times?
Know if we would need to look at it because if that was a direction that we wanted to go, we would then start talking directly to the people that are in the MLPA process because they are, as we speak, providing recommendations as to marine reserves in the Central Coast area. And one of the things that we've been told repeatedly is that the major impediment to the MLPA process right now is that there is no long-term funding for enforcement and monitoring. And so that would be a direction that perhaps that the funds could go, if that's the direction that the board wants to go, is toward the long-term funding of enforcement and monitoring that's associated with the legal designation of these reserves. And they're if you follow some of the maps that have been proposed, they'd be of sufficient size to address our concerns.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. Actually, you just mentioned the issue that I wanted to bring up, which was the kind of the timing of this effort relative to the process, the public process that's going on to support developing MLPAs, because we, I think, have a great understanding and appreciation of the role of the public and of stakeholders in developing and devising this network and strategy effort that's going on, a great deal of effort. So how would the timing of that process fit in with what we need to understand and do?
Well, there's people here that are better versed in this than me that you could ask that same question to. We've been very careful, I've been in particular, the three of us have been very careful not to get involved at all in the MLPA process because we view this as a potential conflict of interest, you know, throughout this. And so beyond what I just said, I know almost nothing about the MLPA process, but there are people here that could address that.
Okay.
One other question.
Sure. Mr. Jeffries.
Was there any consideration taken into if this is a no-take zone?
Are we talking about the reef now?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, that whole area looks like about 77 miles long, 3 miles wide area.
That area right now, there is an exclusion area around Diablo, but that area right now is a take zone.
Take zone.
It is currently a take zone.
But if it goes into reserve, it's going to become a no-take zone.
That's one of the possibilities,
options.
Yes.
Well, my concern is what does it do to the economic issue with the commercial fishermen and also the recreational fishermen. And did you take it into account for if this is a preserve or a no-take zone, would this be indefinite, or did you look at for a period of time?
Well, now I'll address that in two ways. One is our calculation of the artificial reef was assuming that it would be a take zone, actually. So that, in fact, the placement of it we felt was appropriate for take zone because it's going to be close to the harbor and north. And so you come home with good weather. And so we assumed that the artificial reef, at least in part, would be a take zone. And the marine reserves, the reason that is up there is because marine reserves, according to MLPA, are going to happen. There's no question that there's going to be marine reserves, at least unless the law changes. So what we are saying here is that given that the Marine Reserve is on the horizon, one of the things that could be done to provide is to provide a level of enforcement and a level of a monitoring that is also required under the MLP Act. But the reef itself was designed to be a taped area.
Well, I agree with you that if there's no way to measure the effect over a period of time with monitoring, then, you know, putting the artificial reef in would, sure, there's no doubt it would increase the population. But I think I would like to know what increase does, what happens with that.
Sure.
And then you mentioned it lightly, at least I accepted it that way, lightly, that you said that with that particular area would create larger size fish.
If it's a marine reserve.
Marine reserve.
Yes.
And then it would possibly, of course, with the larger fish, they need more food. Now, would that also create more food for them, or would they extend, those larger fish would extend out to further areas looking to supplement their food chain?
Well, the way, you know, and I'm going to be completely honest with you, this is almost all the work, in fact, all the work that has been done looking at marine reserves and the impacts on size and density and fecundity, forage and all that kind of stuff is not here. It's not in the Central Coast. So we're basing a lot of this information on work that's been done elsewhere. And elsewhere is typically elsewhere where things are heavily fished. So when we say that marine reserves have been shown to increase the size of fish, that's in areas where there's been heavy take. When we say that it's been, you know, shown to be important for the density, that's also been in areas where there's heavy take. And what happens when you establish a marine reserve in those areas is that you see dramatic increases in the size because they're not being taken. I mean, there's size limits here, right? And so you see bigger fish. And you see more dense fish because they're not being withdrawn from the system. Also, what typically has been shown is as you get more bigger fish, they tend to, as you might suggest, eat more. Typically, that comes from local sources. And what has happened, though, again, this is all from outside experience, is that the local forage goes down a little bit because the predatory fish, which most people want to eat, they're not interested in the non-predatory fish for the most part. They are eating the smaller fish, which are also entrained at Diablo Canyon. And so there might be a balancing, but the species that are of most, at least economic interest and public interest, are those fishes that the public can harvest or has eaten, like rockfish, lingcod, cabazon, all those sorts of things, which are taken at
Would this also attract fish that we really don't want into an area?
No.
Weeds.
Okay. I had another question, but it escaped me for now.
Well, Mr. Shallcross?
Yeah. You know, where does the conservation community come down on artificial reefs? Or are they all over the place? Or are they against them or for them?
It's all over the place. There are some groups... and this isn't to be humorous or anything. There are some groups that are worried that they might affect a surf break. We had a huge, you know, study that was done down in Southern California because it's close to Trestles, the artificial reef, and they want to make sure that it didn't affect the surf break. It turns out it doesn't. In fact, it cleans up the surf break. But there are other communities that think that artificial reefs are a source of attraction, meaning that they don't cause any new production. They just suck individuals from nearby reefs, and so it doesn't cause any regional increase in the number of individuals or the number of larval production or the number of larvae produced because they're drawing them in from these natural reefs in the other system. And that's a potent criticism, but one that I think the majority of us feel is not true over the long haul. It's certainly true initially. You put I guarantee you, you stick rock out there in Estero Bay today, and you're going to have big fish on it tomorrow. And they're not being spontaneously generated. They're coming from somewhere else. And that's because they're attracting them. But over time, that equilibrates. And so I think that is sort of more or less dismissed. But there are people that feel just generally that this is not a way to address these sorts of issues. You know, they might have all been from the engineering solution. Get rid of the intake altogether or shut down the plant or something like this. And so they might think if this is an option, that means that Diablo Canyon persists, and so it's all over the place.
Dr. Balker.
I don't know where to start. Yes, I do. Fundamental fact that bothers me about artificial reefs is that if you put an artificial reef in, you take the existing habitat that was there out.
Yes.
And whether or not that's a good trade is a value judgment.
Yes.
And that's uncomfortable thing to wrestle with.
It is, but it's something that you guys and we do all the time. So as an example, at Moss Landing, whether you realize it or not, the direction of the board was to restore or create wetland habitat. That came at the expense of other types of habitats. The same thing is true in any sort of conversion. When you're saying this is
right.
a habitat of importance, right. you have to make a judgment that it's more important.
But it still is a value judgment.
It certainly is.
Okay. What about the loss of intertidal organisms? Now, I'm assuming that the reef, the hard bottom you're going to put in, comes up 4 or 5 feet off the bottom, six
no.
feet?
No.
How high?
Probably no more than 2 to 3 feet okay. off the bottom. And it would not come in closer than perhaps 30 to 35 feet depth, water depth. Otherwise, storms put it up on the beach. And so you have to engineer it so that it's low enough so the significant waves aren't going to redistribute the reef.
So is the focus really just to create more kelp habitat?
Most of the species that that we found that were in the entrainment samples were from subtidal habitats. That's not to say that there weren't intertidal. There were intertidal. But most of the species were... that were targeted were subtidal species. The most numerically abundant species are all subtidal species.
So the loss of the intertidal species, you feel, is inconsequential to this whole scheme?
I think it's relatively minor relative to the thermal impacts, you know, which is a separate issue with respect to mitigation options, and relatively minor with respect to the data that we've got that suggests that most of the entrainment was of...
Subtitle.
Yes.
Okay. Now, what? I just want to go.
Can I just wait, John? That's right, isn't it? With respect to the, I want to make sure that this is right. With respect to the entrained species.
Yes, but I mean, some of the come forward. John.
Do you mind if? Because he knows
all.
More than anyone.
No, I don't. John Steinbeck with Tenera Environmental. A lot of the species were, I think you'd characterize them more as shallow subtidal, like the blennies and the gobies and such occur in fairly shallow subtidal habitats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there were intertidal, but they were a lower percentage, as you say.
So the blenny type species, we would not be... with an artificial reef, not...
They
would
not
be
that depth.
They would go down to that depth?
That's the depth of the reefs you're talking about are probably like the lower limit of some of the, like the Gabonzia,
yeah.
things like that.
Okay. How about this? Just throw this out into right field for a second.
Sure.
What if you had an artificial reef in the depth Thank you're speaking of, but engineered so it could break the surface and you could recreate... both intertidal habitat and
yeah.
go down to the bottom?
It'd be great in lots of ways. The major problem with that is that, at least in the work that has been done, the more three-dimensional artificial reefs are, the less typical they become of normal reefs. They, for whatever reason, they tend not to support kelp any longer. And there's a lot of theories behind that, but that's the other thing is that we would then have a true... I mean, it's not insurmountable, but there would be a true policy issue because then we'd have to get the Coast Guard involved, and there'd be all sorts of navigational... You know, then we'd really run into the morass of, you know, boating regulations. And right now we've engineered these things so that... where they've been engineered so that that never gets even into the equation about, you know, boating, safety, any of that kind of stuff.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. I had a chance to look through some of the record of materials that were submitted, and I'm referring to the peer report that I think you were an author on. And you mentioned cumulative impacts that occur between power plants.
Yes.
And you also were talking about Moss Landing. Can you characterize for us what cumulative impacts you would expect or considered in terms of the analysis that we're looking at today?
So for those of you that aren't familiar with this, what Dr. Hunter is referring to is that we've, as part of 316B and also as part of CEQA determinations, there's always a usually a stipulation that cumulative impacts are considered as part of the decisions or part of the analysis in establishing impacts there from entrainment or thermal effects. And it's almost, it's never been done well. It's rarely been done. And so one of the things that has happened is that a panel was assembled to try to come up with a model for estimating cumulative impacts. Meaning, and what this really means is, just to give a very, you know, easy example is, let's say that you, in an area of the coastline, you've got 10 power plants. That's not here. This is just a heuristic example. You've got 10 power plants, and they each take 5% of the larval organisms. And you think, oh, 5%, big deal. You know, that's nothing, right? But, you know, if you've got 10 of them, now they're taking 50%. And so the idea there is that if you've got a whole bunch of intakes or a whole bunch of impositions to the environment, the sum may be problematic. And there's ecological literature that suggests that once you cross a certain threshold, it becomes very problematic. You know, if you take 5% of the whole population, perhaps no big deal. But if you take 50% because of cumulative impacts, that next 5% might be an incredibly big deal. So that's the underlying basis of it, the underlying ecological basis of it. And this panel that was put together used as a target area the area between Point Conception and the Mexican border, because there's a bunch of power plants in there, and they've had some of them had fairly recent 316Bs done on them. And it was also an area where we felt like we understand the oceanography pretty well, because that's an important aspect of this. And there's a model that's been produced that looks at cumulative impacts, but it is not appropriate. That particular model, because it was done in a different area, is not appropriate for this area, and we have no estimation of whether there are cumulative impacts, or whether they would be more problematic than just adding them up. And the three major one, you know, plants in this area are Moro, which isn't really operating anymore, Moss Landing, which is operating full blown, and Diablo Canyon. If the source water bodies that we calculated there are any estimation of the truth, then they don't overlap. Moro would, but they don't overlap between Diablo Canyon and Moss Landing as an example. And so they would be relatively independent of one another. And since Moro's not, you know, at this point isn't really operating, then that would be part of it.
Okay. Any other board questions? Jeffries, did you recall what?
Well, the last question I had for you was, and you talked about the abalone. What's this reef going to do for the abalone, and also with the issue of the disease that the abalone has had, and it's gradually migrating north?
Yeah. Yeah, that, in fact, I know a lot about that. That's my work. But it won't do anything for it, nothing at all, because black abalone, which is the species that you're talking about, is almost exclusively an intertidal species. It rarely gets into the subtidal. And what Mr. Jeffries is saying is indicating that there's a disease in black abalone. It's called the withering disease, and it showed up on Channel Islands about 1983, 84, and at Diablo Canyon about 88, and on the mainland at Point Conception about 90, and it's been marching up the coast, and it's somewhere around Piedras Blancas right now. That's where the disease is at present. And when it hits, it wipes out populations. They're gone, pretty much gone. There has been a little bit of recovery that's been occurring, but relatively minor. And one of the mitigation options that has been proposed for thermal effects has been black abalone sort of restoration and culturing work. This particular thing, because it's subtidal, would have no impact at all on black abalone. It would provide wonderful habitat for red abalone, though, and other species of abalone, green, and so on. And so the other species would be dramatically affected, but black's not at all.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other board questions? All right, thank you.
You bet.
And Mr. Briggs, should we... Well, we have PG&E, right? They,
we have cards.
We have cards, okay. We'll switch over to PG&E's presentation. And we have
three cards. Four cards. Okay. And how much time did staff use up in their presentation?
I figured it was about 30 minutes, and I subtracted 5 for responses to questions, so it was pretty close to the 25.
About 25?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, and board members. I'm Carl Litz, an attorney representing PG&E.
Good.
We have a short presentation within our 25 minutes today that's organized, so we'll you have cards for all of us, and we'll speak in turn as organized, if that is fine with you.
That's fine.
With me today is Dr. Dr. Bill DeVosges. Dr. DeVosges is the president of Triangle Economic Research. He is a research professor of economics at Duke University. He's one of the leading experts in the country, by everybody's acknowledgement, in natural resource valuation. He's written 3 books. He's published 40 peer-reviewed articles. He has personally overseen the performance of numerous natural resource damage assessments around the country. And he is intimately familiar with the development of the 316B regulations, which are the focal point of our discussion about entrainment. Our presentation today is going to focus on what has happened recently with the 316B regulations, and particularly emphasizing the interrelationship between restoration proposals and economics. The Phase 2 regulations were passed last July by EPA and established a new regulatory regime that governs the decisions that the board will be making in this regard. It's an important set of regulations that fundamentally changed the way in which 316B decision-making is to be done, and economics is an extremely important component of it. Our intention today is to focus at that level just to present the issue for your consideration, because it will be something that you will need to grapple with during the course of decision-making. In the main, the Phase 2 regulations authorize restoration as a mitigation option, as a compliance option, but they require that the extent of mitigation not be significantly greater than the value of reducing the impingement and entrainment effects. And so what we are going to focus on today is that valuation effect, because it, from a legal and a regulatory perspective, very much impacts what the scale of any mitigation effort would be. I'm going to ask Mr. DeVosges to give our presentation in that regard, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions. We also have representatives of the plant available, should you have questions for them. I have copies of our presentation. If you would be interested in having one, I'll hand them out.
While he's doing that, can I ask a question, Chair?
Sure.
Are these Phase 2 regs, did you say that they're proposed?
No, they are final.
They're final, okay,
but they
thanks.
They are now under appeal in the Second Circuit.
Okay, thanks.
And every issue of any relevance to this discussion is the subject matter of the appeal.
And who filed the appeal?
It's been filed by 3 groups. I'm representing one of the entities involved, so some authority. There is a group of 6 northeastern states that have filed appeals, and they are contesting, among other things, the validity of using restoration as a compliance alternative. There is a group and the use of cost-benefit analysis and virtually every other thing in the rule. There is a collection of environmental petitioners led with the key petitioner in that group being the River Keeper out of New York, who are more or less supporting the state's positions. They are similarly allied, opposing cost-benefit analysis, taking the position that cooling towers should be mandatory. There's a long list of the issues that are being appealed that Laurie Okun included in the staff report. There is a small group of industry petitioners who are predominantly supporting EPA's regulation, but having a certain subset of issues that are more specifically oriented rather than attacking the whole structure of the Act.
Do you see the artificial reef, marine reserve,
possibilities as restoration or as mitigation? Because I see those as two different concepts.
In the context of the Phase 2 regulations, regardless of whether you call it mitigation or restoration, the impact is, the regulatory requirement is that if that is used, then it's supposed to produce a level of fish and shellfish production that would be substantially similar to the amount of production that would occur if you achieved the set reductions of impingement, mortality, and entrainment that are established as standards, except to the extent that if you have a situation where the cost of any of those measures would be significantly greater than what the benefits are, then you apply a different standard. You scale it down. They use the term restoration in the regulations itself. Mitigation is not a term that's used. I'm not sure that there is really a substantive difference between the two, Ms. Chairman. There may be, but I can't think of one.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think there's a difference either. I think that the regulations just use the term restoration for some reason rather than mitigation.
Lori, almost impossible to understand what she said because of the connection. Do you want to try again?
I agree that there's no difference between restoration and mitigation as used in the regs. For some reason, the EPA used the term restoration in the regs rather than mitigation, but I don't think there's any difference between those two terms in this context.
Okay. That I got. All right. Thank you. And what we're doing is stopping the clock when we're asking questions like this, and we're just running it when you're presenting.
Thank you, Mr.
Information. Okay. We'll resume. Go ahead, Doctor.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here this morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, and Mr. Briggs. It's always an opportunity for an economist to follow biologists who are able to show nice, pretty pictures and talk about fish and all the good things that that we like to have more of in society. Economists oftentimes are given a different task, and that task is to say how much. And how much are we willing to give up to have more of another? And I think that one of the important things that I'm going to talk about in my presentation today is the economic principles that underlie this question of how much. And I think that you'll see over the course of the presentation that there are a couple of fundamental differences between Dr. Raimondi and the other independent scientists and economists when we talk about the valuation of natural resources. And I think that's one of the things that I'm going to emphasize as I talk today. The other thing that I'm going to do is to focus on the regulations that Mr. Litz has referred to and how the role that economics plays in those rules and the consistency that exists there between the economic principles and the rules themselves. All right, let's go on. There are a couple of key points that I think you can see on this slide up here. Whoop! if the slide stays up there anyway. The first is that the rule talks about economic practicability, that there is a recognition here that whatever is done needs to be economically practical. If we're talking about technologies or balancing technologies with restoration, we need to be considering whether or not that's economically practicable. The other thing that the rule does, as you can see in the second bullet there, is that the second bullet takes that a little bit further, and it adds another clarification as to the notion of practicability in terms of this balancing of the cost associated with the compliance alternative that you're looking at relative to the benefits that would be associated with that as well. So there is a balancing mechanism that's identified in this rule. The bottom line that really comes from the rule that the way that I've interpreted is that the cost of restoration may not significantly exceed the value of the benefits that would be associated with reducing those impingement and entrainment impacts. That's really the key that comes out of this, that there is basically it's a scaling, that the rule requires you to, if you're going to say do restoration, that restoration needs to be scaled relative to the benefits that are associated with reducing impingement and entrainment.
Just before you move on, and just so I'm clear, and I want to make sure that we're not confusing things, path.
Okay, stop it. Could you back up one slide?
Yeah.
Those first two bullets, are they in the regs, are they addressing engineered solutions as opposed to mitigation restoration solutions?
They address both. They're applicable to all compliance alternatives. So whether it's a technology that's at issue or a restoration measure that's at issue, these standards apply to both.
Okay.
Which slide are you looking at, the one titled Phase 2 Regulations Require?
Yes.
I think that first bullet is actually from the preamble to the regulations and not regulatory language itself.
That is correct. It is from the preamble to the regulation.
Okay. And so, Laura, you have this presentation in front of you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, right. Laura, maybe if you spoke a little slower, it would be easier for us. And maybe you're speaking too close into the microphone or the your telephone because it's getting somewhat garbled.
Better?
Not significantly greater. But what about the second bullet, Lori?
That is out of the regulations.
That is out of the regulations.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
The other is out of the preamble. Lori's correct on that.
Okay. And Lori, are these? Is that true that this idea of cost and benefit also applies to restoration mitigation?
This is one of the five alternatives for compliance. So if restoration is going to be used for compliance, one way that it can be measured is that the restoration measures have to reduce the impact of entrainment by 60%. So basically replace 60-90% of the entrained organism. If the discharger can demonstrate that the cost of meeting that standard be significantly greater than the environmental benefit, then the discharger can request the regional board to develop site-specific standards. And those site-specific standards can't cost the discharger more, significantly more, than the benefit.
Okay, so I think she basically...
I think, I'll be happy to show you the right language itself in the regulation when we break.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Young, I'd like to ask Lori. Lori, are you using a speakerphone?
No, I'm on a headset.
You're on a headset. Okay. That might be the problem. Could you use the handheld and see if that improves the reception?
Is this any better?
A lot better.
A lot better. Go ahead. Let's hear that again, Lori.
The second bullet is from the regulations. It's one of the compliance alternatives if the discharger demonstrates that the economic benefit of reducing entrainment impacts by 60-90% would be, the cost of doing that would be significantly greater than the economic benefit, than the environmental benefits, then the discharger can request site-specific alternatives. So the language is from the regs. It's part of one of the compliance options.
In fact, wasn't that in the draft regs also, that language?
I mean, yeah.
That really hasn't changed too much.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. All right. Thank you for that interlude. Go ahead. Let's resume. Thank you.
No problem. One of the things that, as I alluded to in my introduction, that one of the important differences here between economics and biology, and this is something that I talk quite a bit about in the report that we've submitted to the board, is the notion of what's the basic concept of value that we're talking about here. And in economics, that value is based upon, as what I've shown here, how much people are willing to give up of one thing to have more of another. So what value really is, it's a trade-off based notion in economics. So that economics basically recognizes that resources in the world are scarce. So that if we want more of something else, implicitly we're going to be giving up something to get that. And that's what economic value is all about. And I think this is one of the things as we go through here, there is a difference between how economists then view value and then how biologists and other people view value. And I think that's important. The second bullet that I have up there really tries to drive that point home a little bit further in terms of the things that influence value in an economic standpoint. And that is that there's really two things that are important. And I have an example in my report or in our report that talks about a beach. And to the extent that if you were to close down a beach, the value of closing down that beach would be a function of a couple of things. One would be is whether or not there were good substitutes that beach nearby. The more the substitutes, the better the substitutes, the lower the losses that would be associated with closing down that beach. The fewer the substitutes, by the same token then, the higher the losses would be if you shut down that beach. Also, the characteristics of the beach would be important as well. If the beach served as habitat in some way and you were affecting that habitat and it was unique, then that would be another factor that would go into the losses or costs associated with closing that beach. If, however, it was not unique in some way, then that would be somewhat of a mitigating factor that would play into the valuation there. The important thing here in terms of understanding the differences between the independent scientist report and our report is that when they talk about what they're using as a measure of value, they're using the cost of the mitigation or restoration alternatives and saying that essentially equals the value of those alternatives. Well, in economics, then, cost is not value. And the reason why cost isn't value is because of one fundamental factor. In economics, value is based on two forces, supply and demand. That's the thing that we all have always heard about whenever we've had to take that economics class that we all hated. But it's critical here that if you talk about cost determining value, you're only looking at the supply side. You're not looking at the demand side. You also, I think, get to some rather odd positions if you use cost as a measure of value. We use the example in our report that if you're going to measure the value of something based on its cost, if you were to talk about the value of water being based on the cost of towing an iceberg down from the Arctic region to California, you'd say, that's pretty nuts, but it's also extremely expensive. Therefore, it must be really valuable if we do that. At the same time, you also, if you think about it in terms of a reef, you get to a rather odd position as well. What you're really implicitly saying then is, as gasoline prices have gone up recently, as we all know only too well, you're saying then that the value of that reef is increased if it costs more to haul the stones there, the rocks there, to be able to put the reef in. Even though the biological functions of the reef hasn't changed at all. The only thing that changed was the cost of getting the materials there. So this is one of the things as you go through and think about these matters. This is how economic value then differs from the notion of value that's included in the independent scientist report. The last thing that I want to point out in this particular...
I'm going to hold you second.
Well, I'm just a little confused,
ahead,
Mr. Shawcross.
Sure.
You lost me on that last one.
Okay.
So you're saying the value of any commodity is not... The rise in the price of gasoline does not raise the value of any commodity?
What I'm saying is that it raises the cost of that commodity, but it doesn't necessarily raise the value of the commodity.
And the value is based on a supply-demand?
That's correct. It's based on both of those factors.
So you don't take into consideration intrinsic value of the thing existing?
It may be, but that's once again...
In a supply-demand?
Yes, it would.
What if no one demands it? Then it's valueless?
No, not at all.
Okay.
And well, there's a couple of slides that I'll talk about that in the sense that but your point's very good because that's a demand side factor.
Okay.
Right?
You're starting to lose me, but go ahead. Yeah.
Gary, I think that the whole topic is something we can get into in depth with this because it's very germane to what we're trying to do.
Nope.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not germane. I'm just saying this guy's losing me right now.
Right.
Mr. Young, could I ask where our time is?
I stopped it.
Okay,
so you're at 14:28.
Okay, so you got 10 minutes.
I have 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Go ahead. Starting again.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to I'm going to have to go through the remaining slides somewhat quickly here, and I'll apologize for that, but I'll come back and try to answer any questions that you have as we go along. The last thing that I want to mention with this slide here is that the habitat replacement cost measure that's used in the independent staff report has been referred to by the staff as a qualitative benefits analysis. And I would disagree with that characterization for two points. One is that a qualitative benefits analysis is based upon the basic economic principles that underlie benefits. And as I've indicated, costs do not equal benefits. And secondly, qualitative assessment simply means that you're not putting a dollar value on something, right? That you're valuing it, but you're just simply saying that we're not going to translate that into dollars. You're going to go through and do it qualitatively, but you're still using the same principles. All right. The other thing that in the course of my presentation here is I want to talk about the benefits valuation study that my colleagues and I have done at TER on behalf of PG&E for the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. And the first thing that this slide shows here is very simply is that those rules identify characteristics that a study needs to have. And these characteristics are shown up here in terms of the types of valuation concepts, assumptions, and the whether it has an uncertainty analysis, whether or not you talk about non-use values, which is one of the things that I think Mr. Shawcross was alluding to. And also peer review. And peer review, as my understanding is under discussion with the staff of trying to get that arranged for our report. The other thing that I want to point out for members of the board is that the types of benefits that we've counted in our study are inclusive, that we include not just commercial and recreational fishing benefits, but also the value or the benefits that are associated with increasing forage fish, as well as the non-use values. Let me talk a little bit now about these non-use values to see if I can clear up anything of what I've said earlier, perhaps. The notion in economics is that there are two types of values. There's the value that people have from their direct use of a resource, and there is also the value that they may have that's independent of that direct use of the resource. That is non-use value. The value that people would have for simply being willing to preserve something, even though they have no intention of ever using any of the resources that would be impacted. Let's just use the reef as an example. That they would have some value associated with a reef, and they have no intention of ever fishing near that reef or going by that reef or looking at it or anything else. So these are the two different types of values that are recognized in economics, both use and non-use. In terms of the concept of non-use values, in economics, what has been recognized is that the types of resources that have non-use values tend to be those resources that are unique and less common. So to the extent that you're building a reef in an area where there's not many other reefs, then you would expect that there may be higher non-use values than an area perhaps where there are other reefs there. By the same token, non-use values are usually associated with rather unique resources such as the Grand Canyon. There is no other substitute for the Grand Canyon. In terms of the EPA rules, there are some fairly clear guidance that are given in those rules about how do you treat these non-use values. And in particular, what it says is that you only monetize those, you only develop a monetary estimate of those values if you have threatened or endangered species, populations of important species that are impacted, or that there is some loss of community structure. None of these situations, as you've heard Dr. Ramundi give in his presentation, apply in terms of what we're talking about at Diablo Canyon.
I might just add that is from the preamble and not from the regulation.
Thank
itself.
You. One of the other things that I think is important to make clear is that our benefits valuation study has gone through and systematically evaluated, and this is how we bring in those different types of benefits that I referred to. We do it in terms of eggs and larvae and translating them into their H1 equivalents. Those then are sorted as to whether or not those fish are forage fish, whether or not they're caught or not caught. And as you can see, as we're moving over here on the into this category here, then they're then broken down into whether or not those are commercial, recreational, whether they're a non-use value, or whether they're essentially, sorry, Carl, hitting the back of your head, foregone production. So we are including forage fish. We're including forage fish in two ways. As the role that they play in terms of if you have more forage fish, it will result in more recreational commercial fish being caught. But you see that there's also another line here where those forage fish are reflected in terms of the value that people might have for having more forage fish in and of themselves. So both of those are included here. And you can see with that category, we're doing that as a qualitative discussion. The others are all expressed in terms of monetized values. They're all using standard techniques to develop those monetized values. Let's go on to the next slide. This particular slide just tries to show you how we deal with some of the statistical issues that arise with the uncertainty that EPA says you need to address. We use these Monte Carlo techniques to do that. These are the results that we estimated for our study. These results, I've given you the range here that comes from that Monte Carlo analysis. We've used two different time periods here, the time period that goes through the current permit licensing period, 2023, and also just for illustration purposes, an additional 30-year period of time, just so that you can see what difference that would make. And so you can see the range is from the low end there of about 335,000 to an upper end of about 825,000. These are over these time periods, they're the discounted present value, so these are not just annual numbers. Let's go ahead. What we've done in terms of non-use values is to perform the qualitative assessment. You can see the quote that I put up here from Rick Freeman, one of the classic economic benefits books that's been written back in the early 90s. He emphasizes the role of substitutes and what situations you're likely to see non-use values. For this particular site, what we're talking about then is minimal non-use values from the standpoint of no substantial impacts to unique resources or populations and modest impacts to forage species, which in economics would be classified as a renewable resource that has some substitutes that are associated with it. Now, there are some important differences between our study and the independent scientist report. The first one is, and this is something that I've not referred to directly, but somewhat implicitly, and that's this notion of economic services. That in economics, services are an important role here. When we talk about some of the services are very straightforward. That's the use services that people have, but there's also the biological services that are relevant. What economics says is that those biological services still have to have some connection to people. They're not simply independent of people, but that people have some connection, some value for those biological services. So it's more than just simply biological functioning that takes place there. As I talked about earlier, we've measured ours based on economic principles of value, not cost. We've also addressed uncertainty. The independent scientist report doesn't do it in a formal way. Finally, our report does include the discounting notion, whereas the independent scientist report does not. That's important here because, as Dr. Raimondi pointed out, this reef is going to be there into perpetuity. It's going to be producing this flow of benefits for a perpetual stream of time. In economics, then, the power plant is not going to operate for that period of time. So you need to account for the fact that you've got benefits that are accruing in one case over a longer period of time to get the right scale of what kind of restoration or mitigation that you want to use, so that you have to set these things up on the proper scaling, and discounting is a way to try to do that. Certainly one of the other things that we can see is if we compare the independent scientist report to some of the studies that were done by EPA for either the Northern California or their California regional study, these that have multiple power plants are showing estimates that are roughly about $1.5 million to $2 million on a per power plant basis as to what the benefits are associated with reducing I&E impacts there. The last one up here is just the earlier ASA study that was done for Diablo Canyon. So in conclusion, there are basically, I think, a couple of important conclusions that you can take away from that. First is that I believe that the independent scientist report overstates the amount of restoration that would be needed. And it does it in a very significant way. As a matter of fact, if you compare it to the benefits, as the rule says that you should do, it does it by at least a factor of 10 to 26. And that even the marine protection areas with the cost of $6 to $8 million that's referred to is off by a factor of 6 to 8. I also believe that the valuation concepts that they rely upon are completely inconsistent with economic principles as well as with EPA's regs. And that finally, if we were to just look at the benefits of those reefs relative to the cost, that the costs are greater than the benefits. Thank you.
Okay, you have 3 minutes, 45 seconds. Is there more for your presentation?
Have you questions? Only just a concluding comment from plant representative.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and use that time. Okay. I'm sure we have questions for you. Why don't we take those after
that would be great.
Completed.
Let me introduce Mr. Paul Roller, who's the Director of Operations Services at the plant. It's his group that's responsible for the permitting that is at issue here, and he is somewhat new to the program, and we wanted to introduce him to you, among other things, as you will be seeing more of him as time goes on.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, I'm Paul Roller, Director of Operations at Diablo Canyon, and I wanted to give you a perspective on daily operations at Diablo Canyon with respect to the MPDES permit. I'm working with David Oatley, our VP and General Manager, and Jim Becker, our Station Director, as well as my environmental staff, to ensure continued compliance with the MPDES permit. I appreciate the opportunity to present our views today. I also want to assure you that we're committed to coming up with a reasonable resolution to the MPDES issues. And in addition to our daily operations, I also want to assure you that we're committed to in our stewardship of the land surrounding Diablo Canyon. Again, I look forward to working with you to come up with a resolution to the important topic. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. A couple of minutes for concluding comments, if you want to use that time.
We've concluded our presentation, Mr. Chairman, so
okay.
We're ready to answer any questions you may have.
Wonderful. Thank you. All right. Any questions from the board? Mr. Shallcross.
This is actually a question for Lori. I just wonder what the legal effect of the preamble is.
Well, it's basically legislative history. There is a very long discussion in the preamble of these regulations, and it indicates what the EPA's thinking was in developing the regs, and so it can be considered as guidance. A lot of this economic guidance isn't in the regulations. The regulations just say there has to be a comprehensive benefits analysis, and so it would really be up to a court to determine what types of evaluation methodologies were appropriate and how much weight to give the language in the preamble, which EPA chose not to incorporate into the regs.
Thank you.
Also, one other point is that a lot of the discussion about valuation methodologies has to do with EPA's valuation process for determining the benefit of the rule. There's federal requirements that when an agency promulgates a regulation, they have to calculate the costs and the benefits of the rule. I think it's a less precise calculation than would have to be done on a site-specific basis. And EPA did consider doing a habitat replacement cost analysis for the benefits of the rule, and because basically, there was uncertainties with it, and they didn't want to put any more time into it. As far as I can tell, they didn't use that method, but they didn't say that method can't be used.
Okay. Any additional questions, Dr. Hunter?
Okay. Let's see if I can get this question put together properly. My interest is in talking about non-use values. And you mentioned two aspects that you would consider. One would be the uniqueness of the resource, and the other would be biological services in terms of the direct benefits, not just a generic indirect benefits of an existing ecosystem, but direct benefits. And then I believe that we heard from Dr. Raimondi that major impacts occur to rockfish and I think I'm also aware of impacts to abalone, specifically impacts that occurred in the early 70s resulting from the startup of the plant itself, which had a dramatic effect on the abalone population in San Luis Bay. So that suggests to me that we're talking about direct benefits in terms of biological services of a sustaining fish population of rocky reef fish and also of abalone. And also the uniqueness of the resource, and I think I see Mr. Ugaritz here from Department of Fish and Game might be able to talk to us today about the status of rockfish and the dramatic economic impacts that are occurring right now to our fishing industry here, which has been a very vibrant and healthy fishing industry, and which I think is undergoing some very major management efforts to maintain and sustain and improve rockfish. So I'm interested in your views on how those direct effects figure into the non-use category, because I think there's some overlap there, and I think I'm not clear where you make those connections, because I think scarcity is an aspect of uniqueness.
If I may certainly address the abalone issue first, because I believe that we are agreed that that the operations of the plant did not cause withering syndrome. And it is not a causal relationship between plant operations and what happened with abalone and withering disease up and down the coast.
I'm not referring to withering syndrome. I'm referring to a study that occurred in 1975, I believe, that examined dramatic kill of red and black abalone to the extent that 50% of the population in the test areas, which was not the entire bay, certainly, but that there were direct effects that Fish and Game studied and PG&E studied concurrently.
May we have our biologist?
Sure. Thank you.
I think maybe, Dr. Hunter, you're talking about the abalone kill that was associated with startup of the plant, and that caused the plant to switch from copper condenser tubes to titanium condenser tubes.
Yeah, and to my understanding, I'm not a fisheries biologist, but my understanding is that level of kill of abalone probably wiped out San Luis Bay population. I don't know that they recovered to the level that existed prior to that startup event. And I realize it was a one-time event, but certainly it was a huge impact.
John Steinbeck, again with Tenere Environmental. The abalone mortalities that were associated with the startup of the plant when they turned the circulator water pumps on and it released the kind of the fouling from the copper condenser tubes into just really the area of Diablo Cove where there was abalone mortality associated with that. So there wasn't anything detected outside of Diablo Cove, and the Fish and Game investigated that, and there was compensation, and I forget exact, I don't have in front of me or remember the exact compensation that was arrived at, but there was some something done to compensate for those losses. And then following that, over many years of monitoring, there was really abundant abalone populations in Diablo Cove and the surrounding areas until the withering syndrome occurred or first showed up in Diablo Cove about 1988.
Thank you.
Can I try to add a couple of things to answer your question as well? Because I think your question raises an important point. And that is that the benefits that we're looking at are associated with just reducing impingement and entrainment. We're not trying to look at a comprehensive set of different kinds of effects. So we're taking the study that Dr. Raimondi referred to, the entrainment study that Tenere performed. We're using the data that essentially comes from that study and then estimating what would the benefits be for these different various categories if you were to reduce those numbers of species to conform to the levels that are in the EPA standard. It's a more specific type of analysis. It's really what's required in the rule to say the rule is focusing on impingement and entrainment. So you have to have then data on that, and then you're going to look at it. If you were to come into compliance and meet what the rules say in terms of 80 to 90% or 60 to 85%, depending on what you're talking about, then what are the benefits that are associated with just those species? And those are the species that we've incorporated into our analysis. We use the life history information that EPA developed, as Lori referred to, that EPA's developed a lot of extensive information that went into the national benefits assessment. We rely heavily upon that information as well as other data that we receive from TANERA to do those calculations. So we're focusing in on that. The last point in terms of the notion of non-use values, that certainly it is associated with the type of resources and the characteristics of those resources. The role of substitutes, I think, becomes important in terms of there may be a situation where you have non-use values, but those values are more modest than what they would otherwise be. And I think that what the rule says for you to do is to go through and perform this type of a qualitative assessment and to bring into this assessment these different factors as to what would play into that.
Okay, so just so that I think I just want to focus on kind of the bigger elements of this.
Okay.
Entrainment and impingement we understand from Dr. Amundi's study, has an effect on the population of rocky reef fish, in particular, certain species. And those populations are diminished as a result because there are fewer adult fish reproducing. And if we are talking about a species that is considered to be depleted in any way that you want to assess it, and the contribution of entrainment and impingement is part of the impact to those populations, mm-hmm. then I guess I'm looking at the cumulative impact of the impacts of the power plant relative to the overall status of that resource.
Yeah.
If it is depleted and is becoming scarce, then you have a unique resource.
I think that's a useful distinction. I guess what I would point out, and I'm getting perilously close to biology here, so I hope John or Pete will help me out. But my understanding of the species that are primarily impacted is that they are not threatened or endangered species that have been associated with the entrainment. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Can I comment on one thing?
Can you come to the microphone, please? I was going to ask you to clarify, actually.
Okay. The one thing I want to comment on, and it doesn't, again, diminish from what I think is a well-done study, is that there were relatively few species that were actually evaluated for loss rates. How many were there? 12, 13? I can't remember now.
14
species. 14 out of perhaps over 100 species that were sampled, and probably thousands of species that were entrained or impinged. Mm-hmm. Among the ones that were not sampled were abalone. So we, you know, when you say things like, when something is said like, well, there's been no effect on, we simply don't know what the effect would have been on abalone had they been studied. We have no information about that whatsoever. That doesn't mean that it's zero. It also doesn't mean that it's extreme. It just means that we don't know. And the approach that we've taken in our use of the ETM model is that whatever species we are able to do, and there's reasons why those were chosen, because they were mathematically the most appropriate ones to study. They had lots of numbers. They are a proxy for all other types of species that were sampled. And so based upon that approach, we came up with at about 11% effect. That doesn't mean it's true for all species, but that's our best guess for all those species that were not sampled. Of those, abalone and a whole bunch of other species weren't sampled.
Thank you. I hope that when Mr. Ugaritz comes to the podium, I'm sure he will, that we can hear a little bit more about the status of rockfish and projections for recovery of rockfish.
Go ahead.
I was just going to follow up to what Dr. Amundi said. The In the technical work group we had, one of the species we discussed for further evaluation was abalone, and we there was a couple of reasons we didn't study that in any detail, but one of those was because we actually thought there was less less potential impacts on abalone larvae than on fish larvae that stay up in the water column. The other reason was that it would require different sampling techniques, but you know, you would. That's one of the problems with taking an average. You can't really say that that average is going to apply to every species. And abalone is a case where it's probably less.
How much time do abalone larvae spend in a planktonic form?
They have a couple of different life stages that they go through, and one of the first stages is planktonic, where they actually rise up in the water surface, and it's, what, 2 or 3 days?
Yeah, no more than 7.
No, but I'm just talking about the trophophores.
Yeah, 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. And then they develop into another stage that looks more like a little snail, and they sink at that stage and then actually kind of hop along the bottom until they develop and actually settle and grow into adults.
And are they entrained?
Well, that's what we came up with, was that the trochophores, these planktonic stage, would be really difficult to identify to species, and that was potentially susceptible for a fairly short period of time. The villager, this other snail stage, was subject to entrainment, or would not be potentially subject to entrainment to any great extent, and that can be for 7 to 10 days until it develops into a small adult.
Okay. Let me ask you guys this. Do you agree with Dr. Raimondi's group's proposal, except for the amount of acreage that they are proposing be used? I mean, can we kind of get through all this, but maybe get to the bottom line, which is your position is it overstates the amount of acreage that should be allocated, but everything leading up to that, you guys are kind of on board with.
Scale is clearly important.
Right.
It's a fundamental issue. In terms of how you go, there is one other concern that we have that may be resolved. I'm not sure we can resolve it today, and that is the impact that the appeal of these regulations is going to have on what is an authorized lawful compliance alternative. If the result of the appeal in the Second Circuit is to grant the Northeastern state's petition that says you have to strike restoration as a compliance alternative and therefore do something else, then we would say, well, in terms of looking at this from a 316B compliance perspective, neither of the two options that are proposed are appropriate because they're unlawful in terms of meeting compliance with that. And so we have a bit of a wait-and-see attitude, Mr. Chairman, to be frank. We'd like to know that what we're doing is lawful, and at present, we can only say that it is under the terms of the existing regulations, but they are subject to challenge, and in a prior ruling on a related regulation, the Second Circuit, same court that we're in, had reached a conclusion that restoration was not authorized, at least insofar as it can be used as a compliance alternative for new facilities as opposed to existing facilities. And so the question that's going to be before the court is whether or not the logic that it employed in the Phase 1 regulations should be applied to the Phase 2 regulations as well. So guessing what courts do is handicapping horse races. You don't do it. But I would have to say, and I would say that as a lawyer, you think that most of the decisions that EPA made are probably going to be upheld because of a deferential standard. The one thing that gives pause in this case to this particular alternative is the fact that the Second Circuit Court of Appeal has already decided a somewhat similar issue in a way that was contrary to EPA's regulations.
Okay. But if we could put that concern aside, because I mean, it may turn out that the regs stay as they are,
and there's a determination to keep them that way, and that's somewhat speculative as to what the courts are going to do. And these are final regs. So if we can put that aside, I just want to know what, if your conclusions somewhat mirror what Dr. Raimondi's study has proposed, except for the scale.
Well,
because my
sense
is,
scale and legality,
I want to share this with you. My sense is, I think that our board should have an economist, along with the biologists, go ahead and tell us about valuation methods.
We agree.
And I appreciate your expert's testimony, but you know, he is the industry's expert. Everyone advocates a certain position. And frankly, I'm not an economist, and so I'm not going to know how to read between all the lines. And that's a concern of mine when we start talking about cost and value. And you know, you don't consider them the same, but then you do have to take in the money in the end. You know, I get somewhat confused, and so I want to get clarified.
We support that wholeheartedly. We would love to see our work peer-reviewed. We would like to see Dr. Raimondi's work peer-reviewed. And we're in the process. We have already agreed with the staff that we are prepared to finance a reasonable peer review of these works, and we're in the process of trying to identify people who we collectively agree would be appropriate to undertake that task. Having these results verified in a way that gives you confidence is important.
Okay. So the artificial reef marine reserve concept, is that something that you are on board with as a viable restoration mitigation plan? And we can leave for a later debate scale and scope.
We're open to any reasonable solution. And I don't mean to be evasive on this point, but there are some legal uncertainties, and so I don't want to overcommit to it. But we're willing to work.
Okay, that's right. Fine. I just want to know if there's anything that you fundamentally object to those concepts.
It
doesn't sound like
concepts,
there
no.
is. We may
no.
have an issue of legality and then scope.
Right.
And
assuming
scale.
That those are resolved, it's...
Okay. Yes.
From an economic standpoint, they can be evaluated, and I think certainly they can be evaluated using the same economic principles that I've referred to in my rule to deal with the question of determining what the scale needs to be.
Okay. All right. Mr. Shallcross.
Yeah, this is either a question for Lori or maybe PG&E, and maybe it's something that it maybe can be dealt with at a later time. Maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree here. Do we ever use include in this value the value of the use of the resource to the permittee?
The value of the water, you mean?
Well, the value of the water and the value of being able to, you know, kill the larvae. The value of the water, I guess, and everything in it to the permittee.
Well, I think the value of the benefit of not entraining these organisms anymore incorporates the value of being able to entrain them. And as far as the value of water use, I don't see any way under these regs to incorporate that, but I think that that's something that our economist or our peer reviewer needs to address. I haven't heard anyone coming up with a methodology to include that in the value, because what we're valuing is entrained organisms.
Okay, that's what we're evaluating.
That's the economic.
But there's a value. There's a value to the permittee to being able to use the resource, and as far as I can see, they don't pay a dime for it.
Okay.
Mr. DeBosier.
Yeah. Could I respond to that, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
I think that's a very interesting question, Mr. Shallcross. There are a couple of things that you can consider as part of that. One is that the water is returned, so that the amount of water that's actually consumptively used in the process is pretty modest, so that it may not come back in exactly the same form, but it is returned. Secondly, that in economics, what you're really trying to do in this situation is to identify where's the externality. And the externality is in the organisms that are entrained that otherwise would not have been entrained without the intake. And so if most of the water is coming back, the water itself then doesn't become an externality. Does it have value to the plant? Of course it does.
just like we don't charge fishermen for the fish that they take from the ocean. Any type of natural resource that's used goes into the production process. But that's really not what you're trying to get at in terms of this particular question. What you want to do is you want to know what's the loss that's associated with these organisms that are impinged and entrained, and what's a reasonable, reliable measure of the value of reducing that impingement and entrainment.
Actually, we do charge fishermen for taking fish from
the... There's a landing tax, I think, that they'd say.
It's a license fee.
Yeah. No, but I think it's based on production. Or poundage landed. Any other questions from the board?
I'd like to add,
Dr. Villeneuve.
I should have thought of this earlier, but this is probably Dr. Remendi's in your ball court. Having been a zoologist and at one time and before reinventing myself. The fact is that any ecosystem, and particularly in something as amorphous as the ocean, is there's a high degree of, there is a stability over time. And my question is how, what is the longitudinal state of the analysis vis-a-vis the entrainment and potential for impacts that may not have be perceived over long periods of time, added to the fact that, albeit some people don't accept the concept of global warming, there's going to be some longitudinal changes to be impacting the habitat and the ecosystems there.
Yeah. Just to restate and tell me whether I got it right, okay, the question. I think what you were asking is, given that there may have been a trend in population structure over time, perhaps downwards, perhaps not, but is there an added effect of the entrainment and impingement from Diablo Canyon that might in some way destabilize local systems? And compounding that might be any global warming effects that might be currently occurring or might occur in the future. Is that sort of it? Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we don't know. I mean, this is one of the things that is in some ways behind some of the recent regulations within the state with Marine Life Protection Act, Marine Life Management Act. We have very little fisheries independent work that suggests anything about the state of nearshore fisheries, nearshore reef systems. We know a lot more about fish than we do about any other of the species outside of perhaps kelp. So, and John can probably address this as well, but we have very little information about the state of the stocks, for lack of a better word. What information we do have comes mostly not from nearshore fisheries, but from offshore fisheries. And the state there has been progressively downward. And there's all sorts of trends. Everyone's seen all that kind of stuff. I don't want to comment about what's going on nearshore because we have very little information that's relevant to that. With respect to whether Diablo compounds it or not, that's one of the worrying things about any of these entrainment or impacts is that this happens over a fairly broad scale. You know, we were looking at the source water body of being somewhere around 74 kilometers. Some species were longer than that. Some species were shorter than that. So it's diffuse. But it's over a very large spatial extent. And we simply don't have any information about whether there has been sort of a trajectory spiraling downwards as a result of that. My guess is that it would be very difficult to even figure that out had we had a lot of information because all sorts of things have happened over the last 50 to 100 years. I mean, the vast majority of people now live on the coast. You know, 80% of the people live on the coastline. There's been extraction from all over the place. And that's precisely what the concern is that you keep on adding impositions to the system, and at some point the system cannot remain stable. And so that's one of the reasons why your point earlier about cumulative impacts is of concern. Not to say that that Diablo is the force behind it, but it's just another imposition to the marine environment. I hope that addresses it.
Thank you. Because I'm very much aware of looking at the history of and recent history of environmental regulations that just overlooked. We live in a in an era with increasing impingement and stressing of ecological systems.
Yes.
And we're victims frequently, with especially with the regulatory agencies, overlooking or not identifying some critical factor, because it was so, it takes such a long time for these things to take. And so what I'm looking at is we don't want to be caught again in one of the, well, the law of unintended consequences.
Well, and just to follow up on that, you know, one of the underlying assumptions under the new, the recent MLP and MLMA acts is the idea that these nearshore systems are in fact important, and that there are, you know, ecologically and community and species important to stabilizing local communities. That's why there's this fundamental idea that they need protection. Otherwise, there's no particular reason why these systems would have been identified as in need of protection. So the idea that they're not important, or that there's not important species, or that they're completely stable and completely resilient to impacts, is at least in the in this state not considered to be true, at least for nearshore systems.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Hunter?
Short one.
Thank you. This for Dr. Raimondi. This also concerns cumulative impacts. You reminded me of another question that I wanted to ask you. You mentioned that Morro Bay Power Plant, because it's not operating currently, you wouldn't be able to talk about the cumulative impacts relationship between the source water body and your particular study at this point. But it seems to me that I believe the Morro Bay Power Plant fired up in the 50s, sometime in the 50s,
uh-huh.
And we're looking at 30 years at Diablo.
Well, there's certainly a long period when they did operate, you know, temporally consistently, you know, coherently.
Right. So the question I have is, we're looking at a minimum of impacts to the 30-year-old rockfish, and then on up.
Yeah.
And can we say anything, do we know enough right now to say anything about the depletion we're seeing, with those downward trends, and how that might be a confounding feature of this exponential increasing impact to the fisheries?
You know, I'm going to be completely honest with you. The honest answer is, from a scientific standpoint, that I do not believe that we can attribute, that doesn't mean it's not attributable, that we can attribute any downward trend to the operation of Diablo. That doesn't mean it doesn't occur, but from a scientific standpoint, there has been so many impositions to the system that to identify the contribution of fishing versus Diablo versus toxins versus sedimentation, it would be silly to even, you know, to provide a guess as to that. But I want to be clear that doesn't mean I don't think it occurs. I just don't think we can attribute any particular percentage to it.
It's our ability to detect an effect from one variable, from one impact or one source of impact. We can't distinguish that effect from all the other effects that are out there.
Okay, we have about 8 speaker cards, and so I thought we would break.
Follow up to what you were talking about with rockfish populations. There has been some recent studies of rockfish populations locally that have been done by Cal Poly in cooperation with the MIG group. And that's actually Dr. John Stevens is here, but those studies show that the rockfish populations in the Central Coast area are actually have been pretty stable over the recent, say, 10 to 15 year period. I forget the time period they looked at, but a lot of the declines that have been documented in other areas of the state where there's a lot heavier fishing pressure are not occurring in the Central Coast area.
Did you have another question, Dr. Hunter? Okay.
So the lunch isn't here yet?
We had
a couple other questions from a board member. Maybe we could deal with those if that's all right. Board member who's not here.
Yes. We do have questions from Daniel Press. He submitted 4 questions, and I'll pass these out to the board members. The first question, I think, is a legal question, so I'll leave that up to Lori. I believe, Lori, you have a copy of these questions.
Yeah.
Why don't we, can we put this on the overhead so people in the audience could also see them?
Can you grab that, Jeff? There should be extra copies of it. It's going back. Can you grab a copy of it, Harvey? There should be extras there.
Jeff needs
to hold back. So the first question deals with the EPA guidelines on the 316B regulations. So as I said, I'll leave that to Lori. The second question is related to... The second question is... Oh, boy, that's small.
Zoom in, Harvey.
The second question is related to the artificial reef that was built for the Southern California Edison power plant. And Dr. Ramondi talked about that reef quite a bit in his presentation, and actually the research that Dr. Ramondi refers to when scaling a reef for diablocaine comes from the Song's artificial reef. But Dr. Press is asking, how did that artificial reef come about? It came about as a result of requirements from the California Coastal Commission, not from requirements from the regional board. The Coastal Commission operates under CEQA, and they were regulating that facility under CEQA. And Dr. Press asked, did Edison agree to the reef before the 316B Phase 2 regs? Yes, because those regs were just published last year, and I believe that Edison and the Coastal Commission agreed to a mitigation package in the late 80s. I think it was 1991. So yes, it was well before the regulations, the 316B regulations, and my understanding is the 316B regulations were not even taken, you know, they didn't apply, they weren't taken into account because the Coastal Commission was operating under CEQA. He also asked, did Edison propose the reef? I'm not sure where the proposal came from, whether it was Coastal Commission staff or Edison, but the two parties did agree to the mitigation package, which included a reef, construction of wetlands, and a fish hatchery.
Can I comment on that, Michael?
You bet.
At
the microphone.
Yeah, come up, and then someone from PG&E was just to
address this. There was a group called the Marine Review Committee that was established with three members. There was a member from the academic community, and that was housed in Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara. Over the most of the period of time was a guy named Bill Murdoch, William Murdoch, who's the professor there. There was a representative from SCE and San Diego Gas and Electric, and there was a member from the environmental community. And that was Rim Fay. And the three parties had to come up with agreements in the end as to what would be required under mitigation. They went all the way from the design of the monitoring plan to the impacts, and a consensus on the impacts that occurred as a result of both thermal and entrainment and impingement. And then finally, what the mitigation options would be. And they were proposed, and it took a two-thirds majority to implement those things. And so that was the structure of the Songs group, is that there was one representative from three parties, and they had to agree in the end. And the proposal for the reef, for the wetland, and for, there's also another one that Michael didn't talk about, and that was for an impingement modification system, were from that group and primarily from the Coastal Commission itself under their regulations and their permit, not from SEE.
Okay. And the last part of that second question is, was a cease and desist order or an administrative civil liability in force when the reef mitigation was agreed to? No. Again, the regional board did not play a role in that mitigation project. It was the Coastal Commission and Edison via CEQA. And a cease and desist order and an ACL, those are enforcement actions taken by the regional board. Number three, Dr. Press is asking whether TER's evaluation report, which you've just seen a presentation on, takes into account or captures all non-use values of the species entrained at Diablo Canyon. In my opinion, no. And I think Dr. Mondi was talking about this earlier when he pointed out that
we targeted 14 species, and we used those as a proxy for all species that are entrained. When you do a valuation study, I think it would be impossible to account for all the things that are entrained, and then all of the valuation that could be done for those species, and Dr. Press is mentioning some of those here. But I'm not an economist, not a resource economist by any means. That's my unprofessional opinion about whether those values have been captured or not. But we are getting peer review on that report and on the independent scientist report, and the peer reviewers will obviously be qualified to evaluate this much better than I can. So the fourth question, what are the board's options? And Dr. Press is saying, should we wait for a proposal from PG&E and then accept or reject that proposal? Or should we wait for the court's decision next summer? That was going to be part of staff's conclusionary remarks here today, was we were going to talk about the uncertainty associated with the regulations, the fact that lawsuits have been filed by environmental groups and states. I think five states grouped together and filed a lawsuit against EPA. And we don't expect the court to issue a decision until next summer. And for that reason, it may not be wise to bring a recommendation to the board before then. And I can talk more about that when we have our conclusion or conclusionary statements. Do you want to add anything to that, Lori?
Yes. On number four, in terms of the board's options and timing, I obviously, based on today's discussion, it's essential to have the benefits valuation peer reviewed because we do need more economic information. So that is one of the next steps that we need to do before coming up with any sort of a recommendation. Going back to question number one, Dr. Press asked, do you have that up on the screen?
Yes.
Okay, so I won't read it. I don't know that the paradox is resolvable. One of the arguments that the environmental plaintiffs are making in the 316B litigation is that this exception virtually swallows up the rule because of the uncertainties associated with resource valuations. It may be that the court strikes down that part of the regulation. The court could strike down that what's kind of a cost-benefit test, but still allow mitigation or restoration to be used under 316B, but without this exception, the significantly greater than exception. Another issue is, what does it mean for the cost to be significantly greater than the benefits? As Jerry Segundi was saying when he was talking about the mercury TMDL, when there are offset programs or mitigation programs, sometimes they're 1-to-1, sometimes they're 2-to-1. Apparently in the mercury TMDL, they're talking about 30-to-1. So that's another aspect of the regulations that will, there needs to be some guidance developed by the courts or by EPA. In terms of circumstances of EPA authorized valuation methods in the past and whether they've resulted in high enough resource values to fund restoration and mitigation, EPA hasn't applied these regulations yet. What they've done is, in states that didn't have MPDES permitting authority, EPA has issued some permits to power plants under the wholly disproportionate test. That case is a more flexible cost-benefit test. EPA has said it's not a formal cost-benefit test, so no strict economic analysis was required, as these regulations seem to require. And that just required, in order to avoid closed cooling, the permitting agency had defined that the benefits of closed cooling were wholly, or the cost of closed cooling was wholly disproportionate to the value. And I don't think that they used any of these methodologies to determine that, frankly. Once they made that wholly disproportionate conclusion, most, if not all, of the permits also provided for some form of mitigation. As far as I know, the mitigation was negotiated mitigation with the dischargers. I don't know that they used any kind of evaluation methodology, but that is something that staff can look into.
Michael, what is HRC?
Habitat cost recovery.
Habitat recovery cost. Okay.
Habitat recovery.
Replacement.
Cost.
Yeah.
Replacement cost.
Okay. What do we want to do at this point? Are the us to do anything?
Well, we have public comment on this item anyway.
Oh,
well,
but,
yeah, well, we want to break for lunch, and then we can come back in an hour.
Food's here. So
the food is here, and then we have a number of speaker cards, and then this is an item for the board's recommendation to staff.
Direction of staff.
So at that point, we can talk about how we want to direct staff. Okay, so why don't we meet back at 1:20?
Also, Lori, do we have a need for a closed session?
No.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
We'll call you back, Lori.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks. Bye.